From the Mom Broadcast Center, this is Take Two, me, Martinez. With a week to go before California's primary, there's a lot to know about how to cast your vote, including today's key deadline. Plus, part two of our chat with LA City Council President Nuri Martinez, who acknowledges that a pair of FBI raids is not a good look for City Hall.
If I had a way to introduce a motion to legislate ethics and how not to be corrupt, I would.
It's all ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for joining us. We've got a great show today. Let's jump right into it, because less than an hour ago, we got some big news that Disney's Bob Iger is stepping down as CEO. Now, Disney Parks Chairman Bob Chapek will become the new chief executive, effective immediately. For more on this story and Iger's tenure, we have the Frame's host, John Horn. Hi, John.
Hey, Abe.
All right, not entirely unexpected?
No, Iger said he was going to step down in the next couple of years. Last year, so it wasn't unexpected that he was leaving. The question was who was going to be his successor. He's going to stay as chairman of the board through the end of next year. And Bob Chapek, I guess, won the bake-off or whatever you have at Disney. A Mickey-off?
Mickey-off? Yeah, I would think so.
Something like that.
I know someone that works.
Chapek is the new guy.
Do. Yeah. So, okay, Chapek, what do we know about the new CEO?
Well, he runs the biggest division within the Walt Disney Company, and that is theme parks. It actually has twice the revenue of the movie studio unit, and he has been there for a while, and he's been very successful with parks. He also oversees cruise lines and all that stuff that is not either the TV division with ESPN, the movie studios. That's Bob Chapek. He runs a huge part of Disney and has done very well within the company.
Parks makes twice the revenue, huh?
Wow. Twice the revenue.
Wow. It's a shock to me. I think the movies are so out there that I think people
go to a
movies.
Theme. Yeah. It's $100 to go,
I know,
and you got
those people.
Bottle of water is $8.
When it comes to Iger, 15 years, a long time to be running things. How is his tenure going to be remembered?
Through a lot of great acquisitions. I mean, he succeeded Michael Eisner, who was kind of ousted in a shareholder revolt. The complaint was that Michael Eisner had become kind of an imperious chairman, and he wasn't spending enough money. Here's some deals that Bob Iger did. He bought Pixar for $7.4 billion. He bought Marvel for $4 billion. 2012, he bought Star Wars producer Lucasfilm for about $4 billion. And last year, the biggest deal of all, Disney purchased most of the assets of 21st Century Fox for $71 billion. So spent a lot of money, but Disney now is, they have about 40% of the box office in domestic theaters. They now have a new streaming service, Disney Plus, and they have controlling ownership of Hulu, so the big players in the streaming service. So he's left the company in pretty good shape.
Yeah, the shelves are definitely full for Chapek. John Horn, host of KPCC's arts and entertainment show, The Frame. Catch more on this developing story later today on The Frame at 3:30. John, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
All right, turning now to Harvey Weinstein's guilty verdict and where it all goes from here, with another trial looming right here in Los Angeles. A New York jury found him guilty on two counts, third-degree rape and a first-degree criminal sexual act. While the verdict has been hailed as a victory for the Me Too movement, not all the charges stuck. Weinstein was acquitted on the two most serious charges of predatory sexual assault. Now, attention turns to the charges he faces in L.A. Two women allege he attacked them in a Beverly Hills hotel back in 2013. So how might the New York verdict affect his trial here? I'm going to get some answers from Lori Levinson. She's a former federal prosecutor, now professor of law at Loyola Law School. Lori, welcome back.
Oh, thanks so much. It's good to talk to you.
All right. Now, prosecutors here can learn from both the wins and the losses in the New York trial. So looking at the two counts prosecutors in New York were able to convict Weinstein on, what strategies could they adopt?
Well, I think the prosecutors now know that these women can be and likely will be believed in the courtroom. In fact, one of the women who testified in New York will be back here in Los Angeles, plus they'll try to bring in many more. So I think the strategy for the prosecutors is to follow what worked in New York. Have as many women as possible. There is strength in numbers because they will corroborate each other and fight against this narrative by Weinstein that somehow this was consensual behavior.
Should they almost make a Xerox copy of the New York playbook?
Well, it certainly will be helpful to read over those transcripts, see the type of cross-examination that the defense brought, prepare their witnesses accordingly. They have a preview of coming attractions.
Now, in order to convict Harvey Weinstein on the more serious charge of predatory sexual assault, jurors had to believe testimonies from two accusers. For actress Annabella Sciorra, that was difficult because the rape allegedly happened in the early 1990s. The case was too old to be prosecuted individually. Lori, prosecutors knew this. So what was the advantage to hearing from several accusers in this case?
Well, what was helpful is that even if the jurors disregarded some of the women, they had others who told similar tales. I do think it was hard with that particular woman because her case went back 30 years, and that's pretty far back for the jurors to go. It's also that, frankly, the jurors knew that they were likely to convict on the counts, which are enough to have Weinstein face 29 years in prison. So it almost doesn't matter that they didn't find him guilty of being a sexual predator.
Talking to Lori Levinson, former federal prosecutor, now professor of law at Loyola Law School. Lori, what can prosecutors here learn from the two charges that Weinstein was not convicted on?
I think what they can learn here is that, you know, each woman has to be prepared that cases that are older are harder to present to the jury, that in fact they need to make sure that each of the women that testifies is confident when they get up there on the witness stand. But they're going to be more confident having the results that happened in New York. I think prosecutors also have to realize that even though they have multiple counts here in Los Angeles, from forcible rape to forcible oral copulation and the like, they don't necessarily need to get guilty verdicts on all those counts. They should focus on what they're most likely to get guilty verdicts on.
So is the pressure not as high as it would have been if the result in New York hadn't been what it was?
Oh, I think that's fair to say. I mean, the pressure is always high because, you know, for these women, this has been a trauma for so long. On the other hand, everyone now knows that Harvey Weinstein has been convicted. That won't escape the attention of even prospective jurors. And he's not going to waltz into a courtroom here with any type of strong presumption of innocence. The court will try to get a fair jury, will give those instructions, but he's going to be worn down. He's not out now. He's in prison, and it's much harder to defend yourself after the emotional toll and physical toll of being in prison.
Now, you mentioned one of the people accusing Weinstein here in L.A., Lauren Young. She testified in Manhattan along with the two others in an effort to prove that Weinstein had attacked other women before. Is it likely that Weinstein's defense attorneys, Lori, will pore over her testimony to possibly use it against her?
Absolutely. In fact, that's one of the challenges for her on the stand because they have a transcript. And if she deviates from that transcript, they're going to claim that those are, you know, misrecollections and she can't be believed. On the other hand, if she says exactly the same thing, they're going to claim there's a script. So I think she'll feel confident now that they have the results from New York, but she's going to be subject to close cross-examination if they actually go to trial.
So it sounds like she has a tough road, right? You mentioned the exact same testimony script, and if she deviates, it's going to call into question her believability.
It's almost a no-win situation, but she doesn't have to be a perfect witness as long as there are other witnesses. That's what I mean by that, which is, you know, she has learned from being on the witness stand. She may have some confidence, but she shouldn't take it lightly because there will be tough cross-examination.
Now, there are more than 90 women who have accused Harvey Weinstein at this point, two convictions now. What might a winning approach for the LA DA's office be based on what we've seen and heard? Would a parade of witnesses to prior bad acts strengthen the case at all?
I think so. I think that the LADA now knows the recipe for success, which is going with what New York did. Get the court here, and it's not a given, to allow as many women to testify as possible, to show that there's a pattern of conduct. Even though he wasn't convicted of being a sexual predator, that doesn't mean that there isn't a pattern of conduct. And that's going to be key to their presentation.
You mentioned Weinstein does face up to 29 years in prison in New York. He's 67 years old. His health may be worsening. How likely is it that prosecutors might negotiate maybe a plea deal?
Well, nobody right now is saying that they'll negotiate, but I wouldn't count it out. And we have to wait and see what kind of sentence if Weinstein gets. If he gets a pretty long sentence in New York, one has to pause and say, what more are you going to get by convicting him here in L.A.? You know, the unknown question is whether these women really want to have a trial so that they can be heard in the courtroom. But they have their civil cases perhaps as well.
And then there's the added level of trauma and stress to having them testify again, to having relive all of that over again.
That is an enormous stress. So I think the L.A. prosecutors have to pay attention to what we still have to learn about the New York case. I'm just wondering if anybody's actually talking to the jurors there to find out some of their insights. And then after we see the sentence, deciding what makes sense in Los Angeles.
Lori, one more thing really quick with Weinstein. Will he be allowed to leave New York to come to L.A. for the trial to be in the courtroom, or how does that work?
He can be detained and brought to L.A. for his trial. Now, if he gets convicted in both cases, he does his New York time first and then his California time. But there are these interstate detainer agreements where people can be brought to different states for trial.
Okay. Lori Levinson is a former federal prosecutor, now professor of law at Loyola Law School. Lori, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
From the courtroom to the polls, California colleges and universities have a bigger role in this year's elections. Dozens of campuses across the state will host voting centers for the first time. And at some, students are trying to increase turnout among their peers. KPCC's Adolfo Guzman Lopez talked to a student at Cal State Northridge who's doing just that.
The student's name is Leslie Aguirre.
I just came out of class. It's actually an elections course, so I'm learning about elections and how people vote and what motivates people to vote.
She passes a window display that makes her think about the disconnect between people her age and politics. It's a political science department display of 17 bobbleheads, George Washington, Lincoln, and mostly other white men.
It feels very far removed that only these people who come from, you know, a lot of money or from these Ivy Leagues or, you know, whatever, like this very stereotypical thought of what a politician is, can only make those changes.
She now knows that people like her, the daughter of working class Salvadoran immigrants, can make change through politics. She learned it in 2016 when she volunteered for the Democratic Party of the San Fernando Valley, making calls and walking neighborhoods to promote issues and candidates.
It was really empowering to see, like, okay, voting, that's one form of doing it. Political protest, that's another form of doing it. And so it really empowered me to feel that I could be an agent of change or that I have some form of influence over the government.
She channeled that energy this school year into her job for Associated Students. She helped secure a voter center at Cal State Northridge and brought Secretary of State Alex Padilla last month for a Q&A with students. Her big event before she stepped down was a four-hour student voting engagement event she titled Politics Isn't a Bad Word. A DJ plays while students stop at half a dozen tables. At one, they can use colored markers to list important issues. At another, they test out the new LA County voting machine and register to vote. Go through all stations and get two free pupusas. Alisa's Curtis is a sophomore. She just posed in the photo booth with an Abe Lincoln hat and a vote sign. Her takeaway from the event?
Oh, that it's important to vote. And who to vote for, and for the whole community to get involved, regardless of if it's student politics or United States politics, is important because it affects us.
This is a nonpartisan event. There's no promotion of candidates or campaigns. At the stencil table, students choose from several phrases they can have airbrushed on a tote bag. Marisol Cabrera Torres is a senior, and she's undocumented.
I can't vote myself, so I gotta. One that says, vote for those who can't vote, a little bag.
She says she's grateful for voters who support politicians who've created DACA programs. She hopes to become a voter one day. Cal State Northridge isn't the only campus thinking outside the box to get students engaged in voting. Earlier this month, UC Berkeley students organized an event called Votechella. UC Student Association President Varsha Sarshawar is a student there.
We just had a concert with Waka Flocka Flame, where a couple hundred students came out, and we were able to reach out to them to register them.
Yes, the Waka Flocka Flame, who ran for president in 2016 to legalize marijuana. Sarveshwar says the concert the year before tried to get students excited about the midterm elections.
fall 2018, my office here at UC Berkeley did a similar concert, and that was with cupcakes. So, you know, we're always into finding new and interesting ways to get students to be involved.
Interesting for UC Berkeley students means Cupcake's profane rap persona. I cannot play you Cupcake's lyrics. They're not what you would expect at a voter engagement rally, although she did promote voting from the stage. Carol Moon Goldberg is president of the League of Women Voters of California. She praises how these efforts teach young voters about the process.
It's like building muscle memory to say, yeah, here's an election and I'm going to participate. So now I'll start, you know, researching the candidates and looking at the ballot propositions. And it, you know, it takes time and practice and a little encouragement.
So far, the UC Berkeley and Cal State Northridge efforts have led to thousands of new registered voters. Covering higher education, I'm Adolfo Guzman Lopez.
All right, a week to go before the California primary, Super Tuesday. I gotta admit, I'm getting a little excited. This time next week, we're gonna be knee or elbow deep in all of it. Thing is, there is still a lot to know about how to cast your vote, including a deadline, a key deadline happening today. Find out all about it when Take 2 continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. The countdown is on. We're 1 week out from Super Tuesday when states such as Texas, Minnesota, Massachusetts, Virginia, and Colorado will be voting. More than a third of all delegates for the Democratic presidential nomination will be awarded based on next week's vote. And the biggest prize right here in California. And joining us are KPCC reporters Libby Denkman and Brianna Lee to talk all about it.
Hey, A, very pumped for next week.
I can't wait. Can't wait, right? Okay, so the big news, Libby, is that vote centers opened over the weekend, right? How'd it go?
Yes, it's officially a new era of in-person voting in Los Angeles and Orange counties. Quick recap, traditional neighborhood polling places are mostly gone. Instead, to vote in person, you're going to use one of the new vote centers, and 232 of those opened in LA County over the weekend, 38 opened in Orange County. And things got off to a bit of a rocky start. I gotta say, I was out on Saturday morning. The system did stumble a bit early on that opening day, mostly because vote center staff couldn't log into this new machines. The new machines weren't booting up properly because there wasn't this code that the workers needed in order to get things started. Sometimes they didn't have the right equipment. But these things tend to happen in neighborhood polling places, too. In past years, yeah, we've heard about those polling places getting started later. The fact that there is this early voting period for the new vote centers gives you a little bit of a cushion. And by midday on Saturday, the county inspectors were making the rounds, troubleshooting, and it seemed that most of the new vote centers were up and running and going smoothly accepting votes.
What's been the awareness like for all this?
So that is an interesting question, because there have been a couple of studies released this week on that subject. Researchers at USC found that over 62% of likely voters in LA County either didn't know about these big changes to voting, or they couldn't answer a survey question about the vote centers.
Seems impossible, but I guess it is very, very possible.
There has been a lot of marketing effort by the county to get the word out, but I think, you know, even when you get things in your mailbox that say, here's where your vote center is now, that habit of just assuming you can walk down your street to your local library or church is hard to break. And I think people don't read their mail in a large part, especially younger people, you know, look in their mailbox and think this is just junk.
Yeah. Now, okay, how do I find my vote center?
Yes, you can go online at LAist.com. There are the mailers that have been sent out if you happen to have saved one of those. There's even a booklet that LA County sent out with the locations of all the vote centers in the county. Go online. That LAist.com is probably the easiest way, though, to find the information that you need in your county.
All right, Brianna Lee, speaking of questions, you've been fielding questions from voters as part of KPCC and LAist's voter game plan. What have been the big questions this week?
Yeah, so one question we've been getting lately is, if I received a vote by mail ballot, can I still choose to vote in person instead? And the answer is yes, you definitely can. Plus, if you're in LA or Orange County, you don't even have to trade in your vote by mail ballot when you go to the voting center. That's because these counties are using an electronic check-in system that can see whether you've already voted by mail. That being said, if you are voting in person in Ventura or Riverside or San Bernardino counties, you should probably bring your vote by mail ballot with you, because these counties are not using the same electronic check-in system. So if you bring your ballot, you can probably avoid any potential issues. That all being said, if you forget, that's okay. You can still vote provisionally. Aside from that, we are still hearing a lot from people who are wondering how they can vote in the presidential primary if they are not registered with any party.
Ooh, okay. So how does that work?
So if you are registered as no party preference, you can request a crossover ballot to vote in the Democratic primary as well as the Libertarian or American Independent primaries. All you have to do is go into a voting center and just ask for a crossover ballot. But if you're voting by mail, you have to request that crossover ballot by today, February 25th. Today is the deadline. It's a deadline for requesting both a vote by mail ballot and for requesting a mail-in crossover ballot. So if you are in a camp who wants either of these things, you'll want to get on that really, really soon. You can fill out the application online, or you can call your county registrar's office directly. And remember, also, none of this applies if you want to vote in the Republican or Peace and Freedom or Green Party's primaries. They don't allow for crossover voting, so if you want to vote for those primaries, you have to register with these parties. The crossover ballot only applies if you're registered as no party preference and you want to vote in the Democratic, American Independent, or Libertarian primaries.
Now, Libby, as I understand it, some candidates are trying to capitalize on the fact that no party preference voters can easily vote for Democratic candidates.
Yeah, we talked about this a little bit on Friday after I spoke with Bernie Sanders when he was in Santa Ana. I think it's really interesting how much the Sanders campaign is pushing, getting the word out about the no party preference voters being able to request that crossover ballot to vote in the Democratic primary. Their perspective as a campaign is that it's going to be a lot of younger, diverse people who maybe didn't realize when they registered no party that they wouldn't be able to vote in a presidential primary unless they took this extra step. And they feel like the word isn't getting out. And so the Sanders campaign is pouring a lot of resources into letting people know that, because they think that voting bloc is going to be more likely to support them.
All right. Now, so what other stories are you working on this week?
So I am looking at the 25th District Congressional race, which is open after Katie Hill resigned last year. That drew over a dozen candidates to jump in. It's really somewhat of a feeding frenzy up there in this district. It includes Porter Ranch, Simi Valley, Santa Clarita, Palmdale, kind of the gateway to the desert cities up in North LA County and eastern Ventura County. The top contenders there are Christy Smith, who's a Democratic Assemblywoman who helped flip a Republican district that overlaps the 25th in 2018. Steve Knight, the former congressman who lost to Katie Hill. Mike Garcia, a Raytheon executive and former fighter pilot who's a newcomer to politics. And Cenk Uygur, the Young Turks host, is kind of injecting rabble-rousing kind of spirit, very well-known in progressive circles up in that race. The interesting thing here is that there is a special election happening at the same time as the primary for California 25th District voters. They're going to have to vote twice for this race, once to fill Katie Hill's seat for 6 months and another time to choose one of the top two folks who's going to face off in November for, taking over this seat in 2021. So it's a little bit of an extra hurdle with all the other changes going on. It can be pretty complicated.
All right, Brianna, we have a week to go to the primary. So where can we find more information?
Well, we have guides to a bunch of local races on our voter game plan website. There are a lot of down ballot races this year, and a lot of people don't really know that much about them. We have guides to LA County District Attorney's race, LA School Board races, Board of Supervisors, LA Superior Court judges, and a lot of people have been asking us about information about the judges. Plus Prop 13, LA County Measure R. We have all these guides right up on our website at laist.com/elections. Again, that's laist.com/elections.
My wife filled out her ballot last night. Right to laist.com to inform herself on all that stuff.
Well done.
Nice.
There you go. All right. KPCC's Libby Dinkman and Brianna Lee with all the info you need before the March 3rd primary. Libby, Brianna, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Egg.
Thank you.
And just one more reminder, if you're voting by mail, you have to request that crossover ballot by today, February 25th. All right, staying with politics, Los Angeles has one of the strongest city councils in the country. Each individual member has a big influence on the future for the 4 million people who live within city limits. And leading that group of people is Nuri Martinez. She took the reins last month as the council's first Latina president. She represents the 6th District, which encompasses the Northeast San Fernando Valley. I went to her office last week to learn more about her agenda. Yesterday, we talked about LA's homeless crisis and how to ensure that the whole council works together to solve it across the city, instead of trying to shove the problem into individual districts.
The rest of the council needs to figure out how to be able to stand up to their constituents and do the right thing.
Now, today, we'll discuss her other priorities. Outside of homelessness, she has worked to crack down on sex trafficking and made a pledge to improve the environment. And that is where we're going to start, because right around this time last year, Martinez spearheaded the creation of a Green New Deal, but one that's local to LA. It's a very ambitious program to make Los Angeles more green and carbon neutral by 2050, and so we asked for a status update.
Well, for me, the Green New Deal has always been about ensuring that, again, communities of color, we've been feeling the effects of climate change for over 40 years in my district, where we have some of the highest polluting factories in my district, where we have some contaminated landfills that have been there dormant for decades. For example, in my district, there is the Sun Valley Generating Station that has been there for decades. There is now talk about the community making sure that that phases out and that eventually closes, because that is our backup in case something goes wrong in any other part of the city. That generating station is powered by diesel. If we have to turn it on one day because there is a power outage somewhere else, the effects of diesel that it has in the community of Sun Valley is huge. We need to ensure that that gets phased out and it's permanently shut down for good. That's an example of what my Green New Deal calls for.
But what about people that in your district who want to live in a cleaner, healthier environment right now as opposed to 30 years from now?
Well, in my district, I think we're so used to waiting. We've been waiting for so long for the city to finally take note of the fact that, for example, this particular plant has got to shut down. It's not talk. There's a realistic timeline in making sure that gets done. It's not going to happen tomorrow, but within the next couple of years, there is a plan in place to ensure that this plant is permanently shut down and that we replace it with something positive.
Now, another one of your passion projects was to crack down on sex trafficking and earmarked $1 million for it. But I want to bring up an investigation last fall by us here at KPCC and also at LAist. And it showed that your effort ensnared vulnerable female sex workers more than traffickers themselves, and that the women arrested rarely ended up in programs designed to get them out of the sex trade. What's your response to that?
You know, I've been working on this issue for the last 6 years, and the reason I became so passionate about it is a month into my term in 2013, I was invited by a group of folks that were working on this human trafficking issue to one of these task forces. And I showed up at about 8 o'clock in the evening, and so they said, okay, you're going to go in an unmarked car, and we're gonna go up and down Sepulveda Boulevard in Van Nuys. The sergeant that was driving me around starts to point out to the different women that were standing on the corner. And I said, well, it looks like you're pointing at a kid. What are you talking about? He goes, oh, no, that's a prostitute. So you just arrested her on prostitution charges. She's probably going to end up in juvenile hall. This is not solving the issue, because you can't arrest your way out of this problem. I understand the report you're referring to, but it's offensive to think that these kids don't deserve an adult to watch over them and do everything humanly possible to take them off the street once and for all, and to go after the guy who's actually putting them out there to sell their body to make money for him.
So the criminalization of these young girls, has that ended? Has that stopped?
Yes. No, we've stopped. You know, we do everything humanly possible to ensure that a service provider comes out with us, organizations run by women whose mission is to ensure that these women are not criminalized, are not put in jail, but instead are connected to service providers that can actually get them off the street, find them a shelter, find them a permitted home so they can get away from their perpetrator. That's the point of what we're trying to do. Do we utilize LAPD to try to do some of our work? Yes, I utilize LAPD to go after the pimp. I need the LAPD to go after the pimp. We need the service providers to work with the victims to be able to testify against that pimp to put that guy away for good. That's what we're trying to do.
We're joined by LA City Council President Nuri Martinez. Now, also on the agenda for you is reforming the council itself. About 15 months ago, FBI agents raided the office of your colleague, City Council Member Jose Huizar. And then last summer, FBI agents came to City Hall again as part of an investigation into contracts with the Department of Water and Power. Charges have not been filed in either case, but it's concerning to the public. It suggests that there might be some corruption that they need to be aware of. So what do you as president plan to do to regain the trust of Angelenos?
As a city council, it is up to me to ensure that the public does not lose faith in what we're trying to do here. People have gotten elected. There's good members here that are just trying to do their job. If something comes of this, the consequences will be had. But for now, nothing's come of it.
Is it something as simple as just reinforcing that everyone on the council know exactly where money is coming from?
I mean, I would hope that people get elected to do the right thing and be able to represent their districts and be able to produce resources for their areas, which is desperately needed. I would hope that that's where you want to get elected and want to represent your district. If I had a way to introduce a motion to legislate ethics and how not to be corrupt, I would. I would hope that people are here elected to do the right thing. I think the majority of this council is. And if not, you've got the federal government looking into these matters. And if they have something, they should move forward with it.
Now, finally, what should Angelenos expect from you on the horizon? 1 year from now, what do you hope to have accomplished on the first anniversary as council president?
I'm serious about figuring out how to help foster youth. Let's get that person a lifeline to stabilize them and not end up on the streets. You know, that's the other issue with homelessness. So many of our foster youth in particular, are so susceptible to ending up on the streets. And let's ensure that our foster youth, before they age out of the system, have a pipeline to city jobs, for example. I just had a meeting earlier with the head of personnel. I want to create a dedicated program for foster youth that we can say, here's how you take a civil servant exam for the city of Los Angeles. You want to be a 311 operator? Here's how you do it. Let's ensure that you pass this test and you have some tools. That, you know, a 311 operator makes $45,000 a year. I mean, that's a life changer. That's what we should be doing to prevent people from ending up on our streets. We have the tools to do that. Let's focus our resources and help this entire segment of the population that, in my opinion, has not been a focus.
Los Angeles City Council President Nuri Martinez, thank you very much for inviting us here in your office.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
All right, there's a school in Orange County that's really a performing arts paradise, but that's not all because it offers visual, literary, and culinary arts programs. Graduates range from Glee's Matthew Morrison to Pedro Pascal, that's right, The Mandalorian. It's a public school, but it's facing big questions about how they decide who gets to go to school there. Find out what has some parents concerned when Take Two continues. Stay with us. All right, lots of news to get to all day here at KPCC. A busy news day, actually. And Nick Roman, host of All Things Considered, is here to keep track of all of it. Hey, Nick.
Hi. You know, all the stories that you've hit today, we're going to hit them again in the afternoon, but also the largest mental health treatment centers in the U.S. They're often jails. That's certainly true in L.A. County. And coming up on All Things Considered, we'll talk about how diversion programs are trying to change that. New study has some dire predictions about the Colorado River Basin and how much water it can supply Southern California. We'll have a report from KPCC's Jacob Margolis. And a new state audit finds that California's lottery revenues are skyrocketing, but not the portion of money that goes back to schools. And a lot of state lawmakers are steamed about that. And steam's the polite word. You'll hear those stories on All Things Considered at 4 after Marketplace at 3 in the Frame at 3:30.
You know, Nick, yesterday was the big Kobe Bryant Memorial. And you know, we've heard different stories about Kobe and since in the month since the really terrible helicopter crash. I think yesterday, as someone who's lived here a long time, in both of us, we needed this. I think everyone needed this. Just let it all out one last time. And that's not going to be the last time we think about Kobe, but at least we had that.
Well, you know, and the good thing, and those of us who've gone through deaths in the family, there's a lot of sadness, but there's a lot of humor as well.
Yeah.
And that ceremony had both of those. And, you know, you can thank Shaq for a lot of it and Michael Jordan, too.
Yeah, it was kind of perfect. Nick Roman, All Things Considered. I'll talk to you later this afternoon.
Thanks.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Today we begin a four-part series about a fight that's going on in Orange County between a charter school and the local district of Santa Ana. KPCC's Carla Javier is here to talk with us about the project and to tell us a little bit about her reporting.
Thank you so much, Jay.
All right, give us some background on this.
All right, so the school's name is the Orange County School of the Arts, OSHA for short. It's this famed art school. Its campus is scattered around downtown Santa Ana's Main Street, and it's been a charter school there for 20 years. But now this well-loved school is facing new pressures from the Santa Ana Unified School District to be more accessible to the community as it tries to get its charter renewed, and its future is in doubt. It's this really complicated situation, and I've spent the past several months looking into why, and I started by making some visits, first to a student who's been trying to get into OSHA, who has been turned down twice so far.
All right, let's listen to the first story in your series.
13-year-old Aiden Roman from Orange loves playing music.
It just really relaxes me and keeps my mind off some things where I'm frustrated.
And he wants to study piano at this school less than 5 miles away called the Orange County School of the Arts, OSHA for short. He's tried to get in twice so far, but no luck. He's not alone in that. It's really tough to get into this school. Right now, 1,500 students like him from around the county, state, country, and even the world have applied to attend next year. There's only enough space for about 460 of them. And who does and doesn't get in is at the heart of the battle between the school and its authorizer, Santa Ana Unified. OSHA is popular because it isn't your average school. The academics here are strong. The school brags that over 80% of its graduates go to four-year colleges, places like USC, NYU, and Stanford. But the main reason people come is for the arts. OSHA offers high-level training in everything from acting and musical theater to culinary arts and digital media. In production and design, students work on building sets. In a dance studio, kids work on their tap routine. And in a choir room, sopranos and altos work on their solfege. You probably know some of the school's alumni. Pedro Pascal from Narcos, Matthew Morrison, who was the choir teacher from Glee, Susan Egan, she was the voice of Meg in Hercules. And as you'd expect from such a creative crew, the school has its own song. Senior Jason Cohen, a trumpet player, says it's unlike any other school he's attended.
You go out during lunch and you hear, you know, kids singing or you hear music or bands playing.
When he was in fifth grade, he was bullied. So he moved between public school and homeschooling. At OSHA, he feels welcome.
Being those kind of strange or weird kids is kind of what's accepted and what's loved.
Senior Louisa Romero studies classical and contemporary dance, and she's upset because the school's future is in jeopardy.
The lessons that I've learned throughout my time at OSHA, the teachers that I've had always provided unconditional attention to my concerns, and the artistic experiences I've gotten are all things that can't be experienced elsewhere.
Your time is up.
That's Louisa at an Orange County Board of Education meeting. She joined hundreds of supporters, some holding signs, standing room only, all there to defend a school that is now under heightened scrutiny. OSHA is a charter school, which is a type of public school. It gets taxpayer money, a And just like any other charter school, OSHA has an authorizer, Santa Ana Unified, whose job it is to make sure that the school plays by the rules, like
making sure that the demographic of the school reflects the demographic of the surrounding community, which OSHA's demographic does not, doesn't even come close.
That's Thomas Steckel with the district. His Santa Ana Unified colleagues worry that some of the ways OSHA operates could make it hard for certain students to attend. Kids who don't speak English as a first language, poorer kids, kids from Santa Ana. They're concerned about the admissions process, and they don't like the way the school asks every parent to donate thousands of dollars each year. So back in December, the staff recommended the board approve OSHA's charter on the condition that the school addresses those concerns. The school's leader, Ralph Opasek, was not buying it.
I believe it's district administration that has just been programmed to be anti-charter school, and it's unfortunate.
Opasek doesn't think they're doing anything wrong, so the school rejected the district's concerns. And since OSHA still needs an authorizer, it appealed to the County Board of Education, hoping they'll approve the charter instead. If Orange County Board of Ed turns them down, the curtain could close on OSHA. The school's current charter expires at the end of June.
That's KPCC's Carla Javier reporting there. Carla, you'll be telling us about this story throughout the week.
That's right.
All right, now, what led you to look deeper?
Well, I'd heard about this school, and I knew that folks thought it was a really great school because over 1,000 kids applied each year for the past couple years for just a couple hundred spots. But as I began paying closer attention, it was clear that there was this underlying tension between the school and the district that oversees it. Since OSHA moved to Santa Ana in 2000, the Santa Ana Unified School District has been approving its charter over and over again, but all of a sudden, this time around, they had a lot of big questions. And as I looked into those questions more, I realized what's happening at OSHA goes to the heart of a really important issue when it comes to access to the arts and to education, which is who does and doesn't get to benefit. So I started reporting.
And how did you report it out?
Well, I interviewed administrators for the district and the school and talked to current and former students and applicants and their parents. I watched and went to late night board meetings. I even got to spend an afternoon at the school to see how some of the school's 20 arts conservatories work when they're in session. And honestly, A, I had a lot of help from our KPCC listeners and our LAS readers, too, who reached out and shared their experiences with the school. Many were full of praise, but others had some skepticism, too. And their stories and their questions really helped guide my curiosity and pointed me to hundreds of pages of public documents and reports and harsh letters exchanged between lawyers, which all show that drama between the school and the district has been unfolding just behind the curtain for the past year.
So what will we hear over the next couple of days?
So in today's story, we got to visit the school and see why it's so popular. Yeah. Tomorrow, we'll hear from a parent who tells us about her experiences with the admissions process, the application, resume, short essays, letters of recommendation, and audition.
It seemed really off to me. But you know what? My daughter really wanted to go to this school, so I go along with it.
And then after that, we'll consider the criticisms of the school brought up by the school district. And lastly, we'll look at what could happen if the situation isn't resolved soon. OSHA's current charter expires on June 30th. And ultimately, I think telling these stories speaks to issues bigger than just this one school, like those big questions about access to education and the arts and the delicate dance of running unique or innovative charter schools and trying to do oversight of them.
Can't wait to hear the rest of it. That's KPCC's reporter Carla Javier telling us about the drama unfolding in Orange County over the future of the famed charter school, the Orange County School of the Arts. And you can listen to her stories all week right here on Take Two. Carla, thanks a lot.
Thank you, A.
Now, normally having way too much of something is a great thing. Say, for example, having so much wine you can't drink it all. Well, turns out California is making more wine than people can buy. And guess who's to blame?
Millennials are like the wine industry's worst nightmare.
We'll find out why when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. Well, pour one out for California's wines, because right now they're on the decline. And the problem? Well, there's a caseload, and it's not about their quality, though. It's that there's too much being made and not enough people to drink it. There may be a silver lining to it, however. Wines could be available at grape prices for drinkers. Here to squeeze out some of the facts, we have San Francisco Chronicle's wine critic, Esther Mobley. Esther, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Now, there are a number of reasons why it'll be cheaper to drink wine soon, but let's have you break down the first one. And that starts about 3 or 4 years ago. What were wine growers doing in about 2016?
They were planting way too many grapes throughout California. So farmers who own vineyards and farm wine grapes could not find enough wineries to buy the grapes. And we reported on growers, especially in Central California, for whom maybe as much as 2/3 of their crop was going to go unsold. It becomes a really complicated proposition for these farmers because giving the grapes away for cheaper prices might also pose a problem for them in future years, since prices for grapes are determined by last year's prices for grapes. So for a lot of farmers, it was you were really in a pickle, and do you sell the grapes for next to nothing, understanding that then your prices might be similar next year, or do you just let the fruit fall to the ground?
Yeah, it sounded like a good thing, right? More grapes, especially with drought conditions we've had in recent years. It just sounded like it was good, but it's turning out to be not good for them, but great for anyone that drinks wine.
Potentially, yeah. So in some circumstances, having a lot of grapes would simply mean that more California wineries were making more wine. But what's actually happening is that a lot of California wineries are cutting back a little bit on the amount of wine they're making. And that's because they're seeing some slightly alarming sales data coming down the pipeline.
All right, so let's talk about that for a second, Esther, because compounding the problem, millennials, how are changing tastes of this generation influencing this shift away from wine?
Millennials are like the wine industry's worst nightmare in a way. They're fickle, so they don't just drink wine as many of their parents did. They drink everything. They drink cocktails, they drink craft beer, they drink increasingly hard seltzer, whose sales are up 200% over last year. And a lot of millennials now are experimenting with not drinking alcohol at all. So we're seeing the rise in dry January, and then, of course, their sober October. So in addition to just diversifying what they drink, a lot of millennials who are now ages 23 to 38, the wine industry would have hoped to be capturing certainly some of the older millennials as really loyal, steady wine buyers. They're not quite as dependable as the wine industry might have hoped.
Wondering though, how much those factors are really driving down wine sales though? I mean, is it really causing that big of a ripple?
Well, it seems to be. I mean, we're getting data now for 2019 wine sales, and one study showed that wine volume consumption in the U.S. declined by less than 1% in 2019. That's really an amazing figure because the last time wine sales didn't grow was in 1994. So it's really been 25 years of volume consumption growing in the U.S., and it's really just a different set of patterns and habits.
Sorry to Esther Mobley with the San Francisco Chronicle. Then there's also a recreational marijuana. More and more states have legalized it. Does that bite into the appetite for wine?
Yes, it's a big question. Will a lot of existing drinkers be actually cutting out some of what they drink and replacing cannabis? Or is it simply that a lot of the drinkers who come of age now in this era of legalized cannabis will enjoy them all? But right now, I mean, even in a state like California, where, of course, it's recreationally legal, cannabis has yet to kind of infiltrate the daily life and social patterns in a way that alcohol already does. So I really think the effects of that are still yet to be seen.
Why do you think wine is turning off this particular generation of drinkers?
Well, I ask myself that all the time. I'm a wine critic. I love wine. But there's a lot of things at play. Dry January is related to this, but this question of wellness cannot be underestimated. People really wanting to incorporate healthier choices into their lifestyles. But we see the way that hard seltzers and other types of beverages are really marketing themselves as low calorie, as low alcohol, as kind of health conscious. Cannabis is certainly marketing itself as an alternative for people who don't want to consume alcohol. So I think the fact that wine doesn't have any nutrition labels on it, it doesn't advertise its calorie count. Think about that alongside a can of anything. I mean, we're seeing all these canned ready-to-drink cocktails too in the store that's making very clear its health impact on you.
Yeah, they're an open book. We know everything about that drink, and you're right. We don't know anything or as much as we know about the other stuff when it comes to a bottle of wine. But then, okay, so Esther, what does this say about the traditional diehard wine drinker? Who are they now, and are they buying as much as they used to? Because it doesn't sound like it.
It seems that they're not. You know, the baby boomer generation, the Gen X generation, we're reaching a moment where a lot of boomers are entering into retirement, and that may change their spending habits. So wine is seeing this threat, certainly not only from millennials, but also from its loyal, longtime customers.
Now, Esther, you've been talking with wine growers up in Northern California. You just spoke to some last week. What are some of their strategies to try and deal with these changing economics?
You know, in California, we have these entire regions that are really almost planted to a single grape variety. Certainly in parts of Sonoma County, where there's really a lot of Pinot Noir, I think that we're going to maybe be starting to see a shift where some growers are going to be open to changing what's planted to satisfy the kind of changing tastes in wine and what maybe new or more innovative winemakers are interested in making.
Now, Esther, we have a lot of wine drinkers that listen to KPCC and Take Two. So for them, I can imagine that this is truly a time to pop a cork and celebrate. Now, for those who love a good deal, what advice do you have on the kinds of wines to look for right now and when they should be dropping in price?
So these things always take a lot of time. So, you know, wines from the 2019 vintage, with the exception of some rosés maybe, we probably won't see on the market for another year or two. So these are really long-term cycles. But I maintain this, and maybe this is frustrating as an answer to this, but the best way to find good deals on wine is always just to find a good wine shop, to go in, to be completely upfront about your budget, and to say, help me find a great wine for under $15 or whatever it may be. That's how I buy wine. My hope is that some of these economic factors, even if they take a year or two to really manifest on the shelves in wine shops, will start to help California wine be a little more competitive with wines from countries like New Zealand or Spain. And because the quality is there, and there's a lot of great wines for people still to discover.
That's Esther Mobley, wine critic for the San Francisco Chronicle. Esther, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
If you missed any part of Take Two, don't whine about it. Just go to wherever we get your podcasts. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on social media. We're at Take Two on Twitter. That's at Take Two. I'm there as well, at A Martinez LA. That's at A Martinez LA. That's good for Twitter and Instagram for your social media convenience. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two, back tomorrow at 2. Talk to you then.